One caution though. Stroking someone's ego is a powerful tool, but if you overdo it or do it without sincerity, it just turns people off. You don't want to come off as a crazy stalker. Wow, you are the most important person in the universe, and you are so amazing looking too. Saying something like that might get security called on you. Using ego appeals needs to be done subtly. And if you are talking to a true narcissist, avoid eye rolls, sighs, or argumentativeness when she brags about her accomplishments. Subtle ego appeals are things like, "That research you did really changed a lot of people's viewpoints on." Or, "I overheard Mr. Smith telling that group over there that you are one of the most keen data analysts he has." Don't make the approach so over the top that it's obvious. Subtle flattery can coax a person into a conversation that might have never taken place, as stated in the DHS brochure. And that is exactly what you want as a social engineer. Expressing a mutual interest. Consider this mock scenario. Attacker. "Wow, you have a background in ISO 9001 compliance databases? You should see the model we built for a reporting engine to assist with that certification. I can get you a copy." Target. "I would love to see that. We have been toying with the idea of adding a reporting engine to our system." Expressing mutual interest is an important aspect of elicitation. This particular scenario is even more powerful than appealing to someone's ego because it extends the relationship beyond the initial conversation. The target agreed to further contact, to accept software from the attacker, and expressed interest in discussing plans for the company's software in the future. All of this can lead to a massive breach in security. The danger in this situation is that now the attacker has full control. He controls the next steps. What information is sent, how much, and when it is released. This is a very powerful move for the social engineer. Of course, if the engagement were long-term, then having a literal piece of software that can be shared would prove even more advantageous. Sharing usable and non-malicious software would build trust, rapport, and make the target have a sense of obligation. Making a deliberate false statement. Delivering a false statement seems like it would backfire off the top, but it can prove to be a powerful force to be reckoned with. Attacker. "Everybody knows that XYZ company produced the highest selling software for this widget on Earth." Target. "Actually, that isn't true. Our company started selling a similar product in 1998, and our sales records have beaten them routinely by more than 23%. These statements, if used effectively, can elicit a response from the target with real facts. Most people must correct wrong statements when they hear them. It's almost as if they are challenged to prove they are correct. The desire to inform others, appear knowledgeable, and be intolerant of misstatements seems to be built into human nature. Understanding this trait can make this scenario a powerful one. You can use this method to pull out full details from the target about real facts and also to discern who in a group might have the most knowledge about a topic. Volunteering information. The DHS brochure makes a good point about a personality trait many of us have. A few mentions of it have appeared in the book already, and it's covered in much more detail later on. But obligation is a strong force. As a social engineer, offering up information in a conversation almost compels the target to reply with equally useful information. Want to try this one out? Next time you are with your friends, say something like, "Did you hear about Ruth? I heard she just got laid off from work and is having serious problems finding more work." Most of the time you will get, "Wow, I didn't hear that. That is terrible news. I heard that Joe is getting divorced and they are going to lose the house too." A sad aspect of humanity is that we tend to live the saying, "Misery loves company." How true it is in this case. People tend to want to share similar news. Social engineers can utilize this proclivity to set the tone or mood of a conversation and build a sense of obligation. Assuming knowledge. Another powerful manipulation tool is that of assumed knowledge. It is commonplace to assume that if someone has knowledge of a particular situation, it's acceptable to discuss it with them. An attacker can deliberately exploit this trait by presenting information as if he is in the know, and then using elicitation to build a conversation around it. He then can regurgitate the information as if it were his own and continue to build the illusion that he has intimate knowledge of this topic. This scenario might be better illustrated with an example. One time I was going to China to negotiate a large deal on some materials. I needed to have some intimate knowledge about my target company in the negotiations and had to find a way to get it before I met with them. We had never met face to face, but I was heading to a conference in China before my negotiation started. While at the conference, I happened to overhear a conversation starting about how to place yourself in a higher position when dealing with the Chinese on negotiations. I knew this was my opportunity, and to make the situation even sweeter, one of the people in the small group was from the company I was going to be meeting with. I quickly injected myself into the conversation and knew that if I didn't say something quick, I would lose face. My knowledge was limited, but they didn't need to know that. When a small pause arose, I began to talk about the Guanzai theory. Guanzai is basically how two people who may not have the same social status can become connected. And then one is pressed upon to perform a favor for the other. I talked about how this connection can be used, and then concluded by tying it in with how important it is as an American to not simply take a business card and stick it in my back pocket, but to review it, comment on it, then place it somewhere respectful. This conversation was enough to set me up as someone who had some knowledge and deserved to stay in the circle of trust there. Now that I had established my knowledge base, I sat back and listened to each person express his or her experience and personal knowledge on how to negotiate properly with large Chinese companies. I paid very close and particular attention when the gentleman who worked for my target company spoke. As he talked, I could tell the tips he was giving were closely linked to the business philosophies of his company. This knowledge was more valuable than anything I could have paid for, and it led to a very successful trip. There are a couple more scenarios I feel are often used in elicitations. Using the effects of alcohol. Nothing loosens lips more than the juice. This is an unfortunate but true fact. Mix any one of the preceding five scenarios with alcohol, and you can magnify its effects by 10. Probably the best way to describe this scenario is with a true story. In 1980, a senior scientist from Los Alamos National Laboratory traveled to a research institute in the People's Republic of China to talk about his specialty, nuclear fusion. He had extensive knowledge of U.S. nuclear weapons information, but knew the situation he was entering was dangerous, and he needed to be determined to stick to his topic. Yet he was constantly barraged with increasingly detailed inquiries directly related to nuclear weapons. The attacker's tactics would change, and they would ask many benign questions about fusion and astrophysics, his specialty. Once, they even threw a cocktail party in his honor. They gathered around and applauded his knowledge and research, each time with a toast and a drink. They began to inquire about classified matters, such as the ignition conditions of deuterium and tritium, the two components in the then-new neutron bomb. He did well at fending off the constant questions, but after many toasts and a party in his honor, he decided to give an analogy. He mused to the group that if you rolled those two components into a ball and then rolled them off the table, they would most likely ignite because they had such low temperature thresholds. This seemingly useless story and information most likely caused the researchers in China to discern a clear path of research on nuclear weapons. They would take this information to yet another scientist, and now, armed with a little more knowledge, use that knowledge to get to the next stage with him or her. After many attempts, it is very likely the Chinese scientist would possess a clear picture of what path to take. This is a serious example of how using elicitation can lead to gaining a clear picture of the whole answer. In social engineering, it may be the same for you. All the answers might not come from one source. You may elicit some information from one person about their whereabouts on a particular date, and then use that information to elicit more information from the next stage, and so on and so forth. Putting those nuggets of information together is often the hard part of perfecting elicitation skills. That is discussed next. Using intelligent questions. As a social engineer, you must realize that the goal with elicitation is not to walk up and say, "What is the password to your servers?" The goal is getting small and seemingly useless bits of information that help build a clear picture of the answers you are seeking or the path to gaining those answers. Either way, this type of information gathering can help give the social engineer a very clear path to the target goal. How do you know what type of questions to use? The following sections analyze the types of questions that exist and how a social engineer can use them. Open-ended questions. Open-ended questions cannot be answered with a yes or no. Asking, "Pretty cold out today, huh?" will lead to a yes, uh-huh, yep, or some other similar affirmative, guttural utterance. Whereas asking, "What do you think of the weather today?" will elicit a real response. The person must answer with more than a yes or no. One way a social engineer can learn about how to use open-ended questions is to analyze and study good reporters. A good reporter must use open-ended questions to continue eliciting responses from his or her interviewee. Suppose I had plans to meet a friend and he canceled, and I wanted to know why. I can ask a question like, "I was curious about what happened to our plans the other night. I wasn't feeling too well. Oh, I hope you're better now. What was wrong?" This line of questioning usually gets more results than doing an all-out assault on the person and saying something like, "What the heck, man? You ditched me the other night." Another aspect of open-ended questions that adds power is the use of why and how. Following up a question with how or why can lead to a much more in-depth explanation of what you were originally asking. This question, again, is not yes or no answerable, and the person will reveal other details you may find interesting. Sometimes open-ended questions can meet with some resistance, so using the pyramid approach might be good. The pyramid approach is where you start with narrow questions and then ask broader questions at the end of the line of questioning. If you really want to get great at this technique, learn to use it with teenagers. For example, many times open-ended questions such as, "How was school today?" will be met with an "Okay," and nothing more. So asking a narrow question might open up the flow of information better. "What are you doing in math this year?" This question is very narrow and can be answered only with a very specific answer. "Algebra 2? Ah, I always hated that. How do you like it?" From there, you can always branch out into broader questions, and after you get the target talking, getting more info generally becomes easier. Closed-ended questions. Obviously, closed-ended questions are the opposite of open-ended questions, but are a very effective way to lead a target where you want. Closed-ended questions often cannot be answered with more than one or two possibilities. In an open-ended question, one might ask, "What is your relationship with your manager?" But a closed-ended question might be worded, "Is your relationship with your manager good?" Detailed information is usually not the goal with closed-ended questions. Rather, leading the target is the goal. Law enforcement and attorneys use this type of reasoning often. If they want to lead their target down a particular path, they ask very closed questions that do not allow for freedom of answers. Something like this: "Did you know the defendant, Mr. Smith?" Yes, I do. On the night of June 14th, did you see Mr. Smith at the ABC Tavern? I did. And at what time was that? 11:45 p.m. All of these questions are very closed-ended and only allow for one or two types of responses. Leading questions. Combining aspects from both open and closed-ended questions, leading questions are open-ended with a hint of leading towards the answer. Something like, you were at the ABC Tavern with Mr. Smith on June 14th at around 11:45 p.m., weren't you? This type of question leads the target where you want, but also offers him the opportunity to express his views, but very narrowly. It also preloads the target with the idea that you have knowledge of the events being asked. Leading questions often can be answered with a yes or no, but are different from closed-ended questions, because more information is planted in the question that, when answered, gives the social engineer more information to work with. Leading questions state some facts, and then ask the target to agree or disagree with them. In 1932, the British psychologist Frederick C. Bartlett concluded a study on the reconstructive memory. He told subjects a story and then asked them to recall the facts immediately, 2 weeks later, and then 4 weeks later. Bartlett found that subjects modified the story based on their culture and beliefs as well as personality. None were able to recall the story accurately and in its entirety. It was determined that memories are not accurate records of our past. It seems that humans try to make the memory fit into our existing representations of the world. When asked questions, many times we respond from memory based on our perceptions and what is important to us. Because of this, asking people a leading question and manipulating their memory is possible. Elizabeth Loftus, a leading figure in the field of eyewitness testimony research, has demonstrated through the use of leading questions how distorting a person's memory of an event is easily possible. For example, if you showed a person a picture of a child's room that contained no teddy bear and then asked her, "Did you see a teddy bear?" you are not implying that one was in the room, and the person is free to answer yes or no as they wish. However, asking, "Did you see the teddy bear?" implies that one was in the room, and the person is more likely to say yes, because the presence of a teddy bear is consistent with that person's schema of a child's room. Because of this research, the use of leading questions can be a powerful tool in the hands of a skilled social engineer. Learning how to lead the target can also enhance a social engineer's ability to gather information. Assumptive questions. Assumptive questions are just what they sound like, where you assume that certain knowledge is already in the possession of the target. The way a social engineer can determine whether or not the target possesses the information he is after is by asking an assumptive question. For example, one skill employed by law enforcement is to assume the target already has knowledge, for example, of a person, and ask something like, "Where does Mr. Smith live?" Depending on the answer given, the officer can determine whether the target knows the person and how much she knows about him. A good point to note is that when a social engineer uses assumptive questions, the whole picture should never be given to the target. Doing so gives all the power to the target and removes much of the social engineer's ability to control the environment. The social engineer never wants to use assumptive questions to accuse the target of a wrong. Doing so alienates the target and again costs the social engineer power. A social engineer should use assumptive questions when he has some idea of the real facts he can use in the question. Using an assumptive question with bogus information may turn the target off and will only confirm that the target doesn't know about something that didn't happen. Back to an earlier example, if I wanted to gain information from a leading chemist, and I did some research and knew enough to formulate one intelligent sentence, I could make an assumptive question. but it would ruin future follow-up if I was not able to back up the assumption the target would make of my knowledge. If I were to ask, because deuterium and tritium have such low temperature thresholds, how does one handle these materials to avoid ignition? The follow-up information might be hard to follow if I'm not a nuclear physicist. This is counterproductive and not too useful. Plan your assumptive questions to have the maximum effect. One adjunct that is taught to law enforcement officials that comes in very handy when using assumptive questions is to say, "Now think carefully before you answer the next question." This kind of statement preloads the target's mind with the idea that he must be truthful with his next statement. It can take months or years to master these skills. Don't get disheartened if the first few attempts are not successful. Keep trying. Don't fear, though. There are some tips to mastering this skill. I will review these in closing. Mastering elicitation. This chapter has a lot of information for you to absorb. And if you are not a people person, employing the techniques covered might seem like a daunting task. Like most aspects of social engineering, elicitation has a set of principles that, when applied, will enhance your skill level. To help you master these principles, remember these pointers. Too many questions can shut down the target. Peppering the target with a barrage of questions will do nothing but turn off the target. Remember, conversation is a give and take. You want to ask, but you have to give to make the target feel at ease. Too few questions will make the target feel uncomfortable. Have you ever been in a conversation that is filled with awkward silences? It isn't good, is it? Don't assume that your target is a skilled and willing conversationalist. You must work at making a conversation an enjoyable experience. Ask only one question at a time. Chapter 5 covers buffer overflows on the human mind. But at this time, your goal is not to overflow the target. It is to merely gather information and build a profile. To do this, you can't seem too eager or non-interested. As you have probably gathered, making elicitation work right is a delicate balance. Too much, too little, too much at once, not enough. Any of them will kill your chances at success. However, these principles can help you master this amazing talent. Whether you use this method for social engineering or just learning how to interact with people, try this. Think of a conversation as a funnel, where at the top is the largest, most neutral part, and at the bottom is the very narrow, direct ending. Start by asking the target very neutral questions and gather some intel using these questions. Give and take in your conversation, and then move to a few open-ended questions. If needed, use a few closed-ended questions to direct the target where you want to go, and then, if the situation fits, move to highly directed questions as you reach the end of the funnel. What will pour out of the spout of the funnel is a river of information. Think about it in the situation discussed in this chapter of my target at the Chamber of Commerce gathering. My goal was to gather intel on anything that might lead to a security breach. I started off the conversation with a very neutral question, escaping the vultures. This question broke the ice on the conversation, as well as used a little humor to create a bridge that allowed us to exist on the same plane of thought. I asked a few more neutral questions and handed him my card while inquiring what he does. This segues smoothly into the open-ended questions. A brief information gathering session that occurred earlier using carefully placed close-ended or assumptive questions was key. After hearing about the company's recent purchase for new accounting software and network upgrades, I wanted to go in for the kill. Having scoped out the building, I knew it used RFID, but I wasn't sure if the target would go so far as to describe the card and show it to me. This is where the use of direct questions played a role. Coming right out and asking what security the company used. By the time I used that type of question, Our rapport and trust factor was so high, he probably would have answered any questions I asked. Understanding how to communicate with people is an essential skill for an elicitor. The social engineer must be adaptive and able to match the conversation to his or her environment and situation. Quickly building even the smallest amount of trust with the target is crucial. Without that rapport, the conversation will most likely fail. Other key factors include making sure that your communication style, the questions used, and the manner in which you speak all match your pretext. Knowing how to ask questions that force a response is a key to successful elicitation. But if all that skill and all those questions do not match your pretext, then the elicitation attempt will most surely fail. Summary. This chapter covered some of the most powerful points in this whole book. Powerful in the sense that applying them can change not only your social engineering abilities, but also your abilities as a communicator. Knowing how to ask the right questions in the right tense and the right manner can open so many opportunities. As a social engineer, this is what separates success from failure. First impressions are based initially on sight, but what comes out of your mouth first can make or break the deal. Mastering elicitation can almost guarantee success as a social engineer and can add serious weight to any pretext you decide to use. Throughout this chapter, I mentioned the power of pretexting. This is another topic that every social engineer, both malicious and professional, must master. But how can you ensure you accomplish this goal? To answer this, you must learn about pretexting and understand exactly what it is, as discussed in Chapter 4. Chapter 4. Pretexting. How to become anyone. Honesty is the key to a relationship. If you can fake that, you're in. Richard Jenny. At times, we probably all wish we could be someone else. Heck, I would love to be a little skinnier and better looking. Even though medical science hasn't come up with a pill that can make that possible, a solution to this dilemma does exist. It's called pretexting. What is pretexting? Some people say it is just a story or lie that you will act out during a social engineering engagement. But that definition is very limiting. Pretexting is better defined as the background story, dress, grooming, personality, and attitude that make up the character you will be for the social engineering audit. Pretexting encompasses everything you would imagine that person to be. The more solid the pretext, the more believable you will be as a social engineer. Often, the simpler your pretext, the better off you are. Pretexting, especially since the advent of the internet, has seen an increase in malicious uses. I once saw a t-shirt that read, "The Internet, where men are men, women are men, and children are FBI agents waiting to get you." As slightly humorous as that saying is, it has a lot of truth to it. On the internet, you can be anyone you want to be. Malicious hackers have been using this ability to their advantage for years, and not just with the internet. In social engineering, playing a role or being a different person to successfully accomplish the goal is often imperative. Chris Hadnagy might not have as much pull as the tech support guy or the CEO of a major importing organization. When a social engineering situation arises, having the skills needed to become the pretext is important. In a discussion I was having with the world-renowned social engineer Chris Nickerson on this topic, he said something I think really hits home. Nickerson stated that pretexting is not about acting out a role or playing a part. He said it is not about living a lie, but actually becoming that person. You are, in every fiber of your being, the person you are portraying. The way he walks, the way he talks, body language, you become that person. I agree with this philosophy on pretexting. Often when people watch a movie, the ones we feel are the best we have ever seen are where the actors get us so enthralled with their parts we can't separate them from their portrayed characters. This was proven to me when many years ago my wife and I watched a great movie with Brad Pitt, Legends of the Fall. He was a selfish jerk in this movie, a tormented soul who made a lot of bad decisions. He was so good at playing this part, my wife literally hated him as an actor for a few years. That is a good pretexter. The problem with using pretexting for many social is that they feel it is just dressing up as a part, and that's it. True, the dress can help, but pretexting is a science. In a way, your whole persona is going to portray you in a light that is different than who you are. To do this, you as a social engineer must have a clear picture of what pretexting really is. Then, you can plan out and perform the pretext perfectly. Finally, you can apply the finishing touches. This chapter will cover those aspects of pretexting. First is a discussion of what pretexting really is. Following that is a discussion of how to use pretexting as a social engineer. Finally, to tie it all together, this chapter explores some stories that show how to use pretexting effectively. What is pretexting? Pretexting is defined as the act of creating an invented scenario to persuade a targeted victim to release information or perform some action. It is more than just creating a lie. In some cases, it can be creating a whole new identity and then using that identity to manipulate the receipt of information. Social engineers can use pretexting to impersonate people in certain jobs and roles that they never themselves have done. Pretexting is not a one-size-fits-all solution. A social engineer must develop many different pretexts over his or her career. All of them will have one thing in common: research. Good information gathering techniques can make or break a good pretext. For example, mimicking the perfect tech support rep is useless if your target does not use outside support. Pretexting is also used in areas of life other than social engineering: sales, public speaking, so-called fortune tellers, neuro-linguistic programming or NLP experts, and even doctors, lawyers, therapists, and the like all have to use a form of pretexting. They all have to create a scenario where people are comfortable with releasing information they normally would not. The difference in social engineering using pretexting and others is the goals involved. A social engineer, again, must live that persona for a time, not just act a part. As long as the audit or social engineering gig lasts, you need to be in the persona. I get in character myself, as do many of my colleagues, some of whom even stay in character off the clock. Anywhere you need to, you should be the pretext you set out to be. In addition, many professional social engineers have many different online, social media, email, and other accounts to back up a slew of pretexts. I once interviewed radio icon Tom Misch for a social engineering podcast I'm a part of. Radio hosts must be proficient at pretexting because they constantly have to release only the information they want to the public. Tom was so proficient at this that many listeners felt as if they knew him as a friend. He would get invitations to weddings, anniversaries, and even births. How was Tom able to accomplish this amazing kind of pretext? The answer is practice. Lots and lots of practice is what he prescribed. He told me that he would actually plan out his acts, then practice them, use the voice they would have, sit how they would sit, maybe even dress like they would dress. Practice is exactly what makes a good pretext. A very important aspect to remember is that the quality of the pretext is directly linked to the quality of the information gathered. The more, the better, and the more relevant the information, the easier it will be for the pretext to be developed and be successful. For example, The classic pretext of a tech support guy would utterly fail if you went to a company that either had internal support or outsourced to a very small company of one or two people. As natural as you are when you converse with someone about who you really are is how easy applying your pretext should be. So that you can see how you can utilize this skill, the following section covers the principles of pretexting, then shows you how you can apply them to actually planning a solid pretext. The principles and planning stages of pretexting. As with every skill, certain principles dictate the steps to performing that task. Pretexting is no different. The following is a list of principles of pretexting that you can use. By no means are these the only principles out there. Maybe others can be added, but these principles embody the essence of pretexting. The more research you do, the better the chance of success. Involving your own personal interests will increase success. Practice dialects or expressions. Many times, social engineering effort can be reduced if the phone is viewed as less important. But as a social engineer, using the phone should not reduce the effort put into the social engineering gig. The simpler the pretext, the better the chance of success. The pretext should appear spontaneous. Provide a logical conclusion or follow-through for the target. The following sections discuss each of these principles in detail. The more research you do, the better the chance of success. This principle is self-explanatory, but it can't be said enough. The level of success is directly connected to the level and depth of research. As discussed in Chapter 2, it is the crux of successful social engineering. The more information a social engineer holds, the more chances he or she has of developing a pretext that works. Remember the story I told in Chapter 2 about my mentor, Matty Aroney, and how he convinced a high-level executive to visit his stamp collection site online? At first glance, the path inside that company might have seemed to be something to do with financial, banking, fundraising, or something along those lines because it was a banking facility. The more research Matty did, the clearer it became that the pretext could be a person who was selling a stamp collection. Finding out what the executive's interests were allowed Matty to find an easy way into the company, and it worked. Sometimes it is those little details that are what make the difference. Remember, no information is irrelevant. While gathering information, looking for stories, items, or aspects of a personal nature is also a good idea. Using a target's personal or emotional attachments can enable you to get a foot in the door. If the social engineer finds out that every year the CFO donates a sizable sum to a children's cancer research center, then a pretext that involves fundraising for this cause could very likely work, as heartless as it sounds. The problem is that malicious social engineers use pretexts that feed on emotions without a second thought. After the attacks on the Twin Towers in New York City on September 11, 2001, many malicious hackers and social engineers used the losses of these people to raise funds for themselves via websites and emails that targeted people's computers and fake fundraisers that obtained funds from those with a giving heart. After the earthquakes in Chile and Haiti in 2010, the same things occurred where many malicious social engineers developed websites that were positioned as giving out information on the seismic activity or the people who were lost. These sites were encoded with malicious code and hacked people's computers. This is even more evident directly after the death of a movie or music star. Search engine optimization, or SEO, and marketing geniuses will have the search engines pulling up their stories in a matter of hours. Along with marketers, malicious social engineers will take advantage of the increased search engine attention by launching malicious sites that feed off that SEO. Drawing people to these sites, they harvest information or infect them with viruses. That people will take advantage of others' misfortune is a sad fact about this world. and one of those dark corners I said you would visit in this book. As a social engineering auditor, I can use an employee's emotions to show a company that even people with seemingly good intentions can trick a company's employees into giving access to valuable and business-ruining data. All these examples solidify the point that the better a social engineer's information gathering and research gathering process, the better chance he has at finding some detail that will increase the chances of a successful pretext. Involve personal interests to increase success. Using your own personal interests to increase the chances of a successful social engineering move seems very simple, but it can go a long way in convincing the target that you are credible. Nothing can ruin rapport and trust faster than a person who claims to be knowledgeable about a topic and then falls short. As a social engineer, if you have never seen a server room before and have never taken a computer apart, trying to play the part of a technician can be a quick path to failure. Including topics and activities in your pretext that you are interested in gives you a lot to talk about and gives you the ability to portray intelligence as well as confidence. Confidence can go a long way toward convincing the target you are who you say you are. Certain pretexts require more knowledge than others, for instance, stamp collector versus nuclear researcher, to be convincing. So again, research becomes the recurring theme. Sometimes the pretext is simple enough that you can get the knowledge by reading a few websites or books. However you gain the knowledge, researching topics that personally interest you as the social engineer is important. After you pick up on a story, aspect, service, or interest that you have a lot of knowledge in or at least feel comfortable discussing, see whether that angle can work. Dr. Tom G. Stevens, Ph.D., says, "It is important to remember that self-confidence is always relative to the task and situation. We have different levels of confidence in different situations." This statement is very important because confidence directly links to how others view you as a social engineer. Confidence, as long as it is not overconfidence, builds trust and rapport and makes people feel at ease. Finding a path to your target that offers you the chance to talk about topics you are comfortable with and that you can speak about with confidence is very important. In 1957, psychologist Leon Festinger came up with the theory of cognitive dissonance. This theory states that people have a tendency to seek consistency among their beliefs, opinions, and basically all their cognitions. When an inconsistency exists between attitudes and behaviors, something must change to eliminate the dissonance. Dr. Festinger states, "Two factors affect the strength of the dissonance: the number of dissonant beliefs and the importance of each belief." He then stated that three ways exist to eliminate dissonance, which should cause every social engineer's ears to perk up. 1. Reduce the importance of the dissonant belief. 2. Add more consonant beliefs that outweigh the dissonant ones. And 3. Change the dissonant beliefs so they are no longer inconsistent. How does a social engineer use this information? Approaching a pretext with lack of confidence when your pretext says that you should be confident automatically creates dissonance. This dissonance raises all sorts of red flags and puts barriers up to rapport, trust, and forward motion. These barriers affect the target's behavior, who is then expected to balance out her feelings of dissonance and kills any likelihood of your pretext working. One of the methods to counter this is to add more consonant beliefs so that they outweigh the dissonant ones. What would the target expect of your pretext? Knowing that will allow you to feed their minds and emotions with actions, words, and attitudes that will build the belief system and outweigh any beliefs that might be in doubt. Of course, a skilled social engineer can also change the dissonant beliefs so they are no longer inconsistent. Although this is trickier, it is a powerful skill to have. It is possible that your appearance does not fit with what the target might envision for your pretext. You might think back to the show Doogie Howser, M.D. Doogie's problem was that his pretext of being a top doctor never fit since he was so young. That was a dissonant belief, but his knowledge and actions often brought that into the consonant beliefs of his targets. Just like the previous example, a social engineer can align his pretext with the target's beliefs by their attitudes, actions, and especially their knowledge of the pretext. One example of this I recently saw in real life was at DEFCON 18. I was part of the team that brought the social engineering CTF to DEFCON. We saw many contestants who used the pretext of an internal employee. When presented with an objection like, "What is your employee badge number?" an unskilled social engineer would get nervous and either not have an answer or hang up, whereas a skilled social engineer would bring those dissonant beliefs into alignment for the target. Simply stating a badge number they found online or using another method, they were able to convince the target that information was not needed, therefore aligning the target to their beliefs. These points are very technical answers to a very simple problem. But you must understand that one can do only so much faking. Choose your path wisely. Practice dialects or expressions. Learning to speak in a different dialect cannot be glossed over quickly. Depending on where you live, learning to speak a different dialect or with an accent can take some time. Putting on a southern drawl or an Asian accent can be very difficult, if not impossible. Once I was in a training class with an international sales organization, and it had some statistics that said 70% of Americans prefer to listen to people with a British accent. I'm not sure if that statistic is true or not, but I can say that I enjoy the accent myself. Now, after that class, I heard quite a few people in the class practice their "Cheerios" and "Hello, Governors," which were horrible. I have a good friend from the UK, John, who gets very angry when he hears Americans trying to use lines from Mary Poppins in an imitation British accent. If he had heard this group, he might have blown a fuse. What that class taught me was that although the stats might say one accent is better than another for sales or just because you may be social engineering in the South or in Europe, doesn't mean you can easily put on the accent to make you appear local. When in doubt, throw it out. If you can't make the dialect perfect, if you can't be natural, and if you can't be smooth, then just don't try. Actors use vocal coaches and training sessions to learn to speak clearly in the accent they have to portray. Actor Christian Bale is from Wales, but determining that fact from listening to him is very difficult. He doesn't sound British in most of his movies. Actor Gwyneth Paltrow took on a very convincing British accent for the movie Shakespeare in Love. Most actors have dialect coaches who will work with them to perfect the target accent. Because most social engineers cannot afford a dialect coach, there are many publications that help you learn at least the basics of putting on an accent, such as Dialects for the Stage by Evangeline Matchlin. Although this is an older book, it contains a lot of great tips. Find native examples of the accent you want to learn to listen to. Books like Dialects for the Stage often come with audio tapes full of accents to listen to. Try speaking along with the recording you have to practice sounding like that person. After you feel somewhat confident, record yourself speaking in that accent so you can listen to it later on and correct errors. Create a scenario and practice your new accent with a partner. Apply your accent in public to see if people find it believable. There are innumerable dialects and accents, and I personally find it helpful to write out phonetically some of the sentences I will speak. This enables me to practice reading them and get the ideas sunk into my brain to make my accent more neutral. These tips can help a social engineer master or at least become proficient at using another dialect. Even if you cannot master another dialect, learning expressions that are used in the area in which you are working can make a difference. One idea is to spend some time listening to people in public talk to one another. A great place for this is a diner or a shopping mall, or any public place you might find groups of people sitting and chatting. Listen closely to phrases or key words. If you hear them used in a few conversations, you might want to find a way to incorporate these into your pretext to add believability. Again, this exercise takes research and practice. Using the phone should not reduce the effort for the social engineer. In recent years, the internet has come to dominate certain more impersonal aspects of social engineering, whereas in days past, the phone was an integral part of social engineering. Because of this shift, many social engineers do not put the energy or effort into phone usage that can make it truly successful. This topic is here to show that the phone is still one of the most powerful tools of the social engineer, and the effort put into using it should not be diminished due to the impersonal nature of the internet. Sometimes, when a social engineer plans a phone attack, his thinking may differ because using the internet might appear easier. Note that you should plan to put the same level of effort, the same level and depth of research and information gathering, and, most importantly, the same level of practice into your phone-based social engineering attacks. I was once with a small group that was going to practice phone presentations. We outlined the proper methods, the tone, the speed, the pitches, and the words to use. We outlined a script, more on this in a minute, and then launched a session. The first person made the call, got on the phone with someone, and messed up the first few lines. Out of complete embarrassment and fear, he just hung up on the person. There is a very good lesson there. The person on the other end of the phone has no clue what you're going to say, so you can't really mess up. Practice sessions can help you learn how to handle the unknowns caused by your accidentally altering something in your script that throws you off base. If you are not as fortunate to have a group to practice or hone these skills with, you will have to get creative. Try calling family or friends to see how far you can get manipulating them. Another way to practice is to record yourself as if you were on the phone and then play it back later to hear how you sound. Personally, I feel that using an outlined script is very important. Here is an illustration. Suppose you had to call your phone company or another utility. Maybe they messed up a bill or you had another service problem and you're going to complain. After you explain yourself to the rep, telling her how upset and disappointed you are, and the rep does absolutely nothing for you, she says something like, X, Y, and Z is committed to excellence and service. Have I answered all your questions today? If the drone behind the phone thought for 1 second about what she was asking, she would realize how silly it is, right? This is what happens when you use a written-out script instead of an outline. An outline allows you creative artistic freedom to move around in the conversation and not be so worried about what must come next. Using the phone to solidify your pretext is one of the quickest methods inside your target's door. The phone allows the social engineer to spoof or fake almost anything. Take into consideration this example. If I wanted to call you and pretend I was in a bustling office to add to the pretext I was trying to use, I could simply grab the audio track from The Thriving Office at www.thrivingoffice.com. This site offers a track called Busy and another called Very Busy. From the creators, this valuable CD, which is filled with the sounds people expect to hear from an established company, provides instant credibility. It's simple, effective, and guaranteed. That sentence alone is filled with social engineering goodness, filled with what people expect to hear from an established company. Already you can see that the CD is geared to fill expectations and provide credibility, at least in the target's mind, after his expectations are met, thereby automatically building trust. In addition, spoofing caller ID information is relatively simple. Services like SpoofCard at SpoofCard.com or using homegrown solutions allows a social engineer to tell the target you are calling from a corporate headquarters, the White House, or local bank. With these services, you can spoof the number to be coming from anywhere in the world. The phone is a deadly tool for social engineers, developing the habits to practice using it and to treat it with utter respect will enhance any social engineer's toolset for pretexting. Because the phone is such a deadly tool and has not lost its effectiveness, you should give it the time and effort it deserves in any social engineering gig. The simpler the pretext, the better the chance of success. The simpler the better principle just can't be overstated. If the pretext has so many intricate details that forgetting one will cause a social engineering failure, it is probably going to fail. Keeping the storylines, facts, and details simple can help build credibility. Dr. Paul Ekman, a renowned psychologist and researcher in the field of human deception, co-wrote an article in 1993 entitled Lies That Fail. In that article, he says, "There is not always time to prepare the line to be taken, to rehearse and memorize it. Even when there has been ample advance notice and a false line has been carefully devised, the liar may not be clever enough to anticipate all the questions that may be asked and to have thought through what his answers must be. Even cleverness may not be enough, for unseen changes in circumstances can betray an otherwise effective line. And even when a liar is not forced by circumstances to change lines, some liars have trouble recalling the line they have previously committed themselves to, so that new questions cannot be consistently answered quickly. This very salient point explains clearly why simple is better. Trying to remember a pretext can be almost impossible if it is so complex that your cover can be blown by a simple mistake. The pretext should be natural and smooth. It should be easy to remember. And if it feels natural to you, then recalling facts or lines used previously in the pretext will not be a task. To illustrate how important it is to remember the small details, I want to share a story with you. Once upon a time, I tried my hand at sales. I was placed with a sales manager to learn the ropes. I can recall my first call with him. We drove up to the house, and before we left the car, he looked at the info card and told me, "Remember, Becky Smith sent in a request card for supplemental insurance. We will present the XYZ policy. Watch and learn." In the first 3 minutes of the sales call, he called her Beth and Betty. Each time he used the wrong name, I saw her demeanor change, and then she would say quietly, "Becky." I feel we could have been giving away gold bullion, and she would have said no. She was so turned off that he couldn't get her name right that she was not interested in listening to anything. This scenario really drives home the point of keeping the simple facts straight. In addition to remembering the facts, it is equally important to keep the details small. A simple pretext allows for the story to grow and the target to use their imagination to fill in the gaps. Do not try to make the pretext elaborate. And above all, remember the tiny details that will make the difference in how people view the pretext. On the other hand, here is an interesting tidbit. A popular tactic used by famous criminals and con men is to purposely make a few mistakes. The thought is that no one is perfect, and a few mistakes make people feel at home. Be cautious with what types of mistakes you decide to make if you employ this tactic, because it does add complexity to your pretext. But it does make the conversation seem more natural. Use this tip sparingly. However you decide to proceed, keep it simple. Let me tie all this together with a few examples that I have used or seen used in audits. After some excellent elicitation on the phone, a nameless social engineer had been given the name of the waste removal company. A few simple internet searches, and he had a usable and printable logo. There are dozens of